You're listening to Steve Bertrand on Books. For 4 years running now, Rebecca Mackay has had a story selected for the Best American Short Stories Anthology. That's a feat. She's been called a rock star of the genre, and she's with us today without the entourage.
But I get to destroy the studio after I'm done, right?
A la Pete Townsend. So I'm a little embarrassed because I think I was, people who listen to this podcast know I'm a fan of your novels, but I was kind of misintroduced to you. I didn't realize that short stories were your forte.
That's not unusual. I mean, I think, you know, for people who read short stories, people who read literary magazines, which is a very small subset of readers, they knew me first through short stories. I was making my name with those in this kind of small bubble for a few years, even before my first novel came out. And it happens that I really didn't have a collection until the two novels were already out in the world. So the time was right. But some of these stories, although I've reworked them, are 10, 12 years old, and some of them are brand new. It really encompasses the timeline of my career.
I'm thinking of The Briefcase. It's been carried around.
Yeah, The Briefcase is a story that's had this long publication history before Music for Wartime. It was in the Best American Short Stories, Best American Run Required Reading. It's even in some textbooks, which really freaks me out. Like, That's not really what any writer dreams of, is people being made to read your short, like people being forced to read your story under duress and then answer like workbook questions about it. Not quite the dream. It's cool. But it's
you're not
going
to throw it back. That fish isn't. The fish is going to stay in the boat.
But yeah. I'll take it.
You mentioned the title of the collection, which I didn't. So thank you for that. Music for Wartime. I've talked to a lot of writers, you know, and they say that short stories are often harder to write than a novel. And so getting ready to talk to you, I was thinking of it, and I think they're harder to read for a reader, too, than a novel.
They can be. I think that there's still part of us that craves the epic. As much as we talk about short attention spans and, oh, everything needs to be bite-sized now, at the same time, look at what we're watching on TV. We're watching things with huge, epic, sweeping arcs. But there's something really beautiful about a short story. There's a kind of perfection you can achieve in a short story. I'm not speaking personally there.
Which
but it
one
can
of yours is perfect, Rebecca?
Oh, all of them. Come right. on. No, but there is this. I'm thinking of a story like The Lottery by Shirley Jackson, that it doesn't need to be any longer than it is. It's perfect the way it is, and any longer and it would fall apart, I think.
Right. Know? So we're talking about two different things in a way, because for me, that it's, when I say it's harder for a reader, it's because the demand is greater. I mean, every word counts. You can't skim a couple of paragraphs
That's
in a
true.
Short story.
Yeah, you got to pay attention.
And you've said that you think this is the best book you've written, this compilation.
Yeah, I do.
And then in the next breath, I think it was to the Tribune, you said, and it won't sell.
I know, I probably shouldn't have said that on the record. Unfortunately, in that same article, they had my editor in there being like, and it's going to sell, great. I think I'm just trying to be realistic about it, and that's been borne out since the book came out a couple months ago. It's had a very strong readership, but that readership is pretty much always going to be smaller than it would be for novels. It's a very intelligent audience. It's a self-selecting audience, and maybe people who tend to be a little bit insiders or a little hipper to what's going on in the literary world, in the same way that, you know, every year I watch the Oscars. And the short film things come on, and it's like, this is great. These look amazing. But
I'm
going to
watch
them
all this year, right?
Sure, right. You never do. And like, I'm going to go make popcorn when they're announcing those. But I know that they really matter to filmmakers. I know that there's probably brilliant stuff in there that's probably way better than some of the big blockbusters getting the big Oscar nods. So I understand why, to a very casual reader, maybe short stories don't have that outside appeal, but they ought to, you know?
And I didn't mean that they're not appealing and that they're not.
What exactly are you saying?
I said that
they're
work. I just, you know, it's, but it is a little more demanding because it all matters.
Yes.
When I'm reading a novel, I can, you know, when I'm getting ready to bed, I'll just get to the chapter, right?
And they often are things that you need to think about. You know, the plot points might not be. And I'm not talking about myself here, actually. But
you
the plot
can
points
talk about. It's okay. You can talk about. I mean, you're at the level where it's. Oh, you're right. You are talking about yourself, even if you're not.
Well, here's what I was going to say. I was going to say that for a lot of short stories, and here I am not talking about myself. The turns are very subtle. The revelation is a very subtle one at the end. A lot of short stories don't have a lot of plot in them. Mine do, actually. You know, I have like dead elephants and Johann Sebastian Bach appears in someone's apartment and starts having an affair with her. So I have these kind of plottier elements to my short stories. But there are a lot of them out there that are just really dry and subtle that are beautiful, but I can see why the average reader might not latch on.
So we've already established that these stories were written over a period of time. Mm-hmm. As someone who's read both of your novels, I kind of recognize a couple things. And I just wonder, do you borrow from your short stories to put in the novel or the other way around? Is that I'm talking really about the November story where it hit me, because I think there's a scene where the woman telling the story, the TV producer, is spying on a couple from an attic window. And in the 100-year house, the attic window played quite a role.
Ooh. No, I'm not, you know, it's totally subconscious. I think there are many ways where, you know, you just get I'm tempted to say it negatively and say get stuck on the same themes. But, you know, if we're lucky, as writers, our ruts are perceived as themes.
Right.
So I could say that I have themes to my work. You know, there are certain spaces, maybe like attics, that are really evocative to me that I'm going to dwell on. Or certain thematic concerns like migration is something, you know, in my first book, The Borrower, the main character there is running away from home, dwelling on how her father was a Russian refugee. This collection, Music for Wartime, has a lot of stuff about runaways in certain ones of the stories, but there are also personal pieces about my family, my father who was a Hungarian refugee, my grandparents who survived World War II in really strange ways.
And the briefcase is about that in a way, right?
Exactly, yeah.
The Worst You'll Ever Feel, is that the correct title, is about that in a way?
There are a lot of them. That The Briefcase, for instance, is a story about a man who was in a chain gang. We don't know when or where exactly, but being dragged through town in this chain gang, escapes it, and then watches as another man is randomly pulled in to fill his vacated spot. And he picks up the briefcase that this guy, who's actually a professor, has left behind, and runs with it, and tries to use what's in the briefcase to form some kind of new temporary life just to survive.
You said in an interview that that's how you're interested in how we pretend our way into a life.
Yeah.
And that's sort of what's going on there in the briefcase.
It
Expand
is.
On that for me.
It is. I mean, I think in one way or another, we're all filling roles, right? We do our job. That's kind of stepping into a pre-existing role. Or, you know, you try to present yourself to the world in a certain way. And what I'm interested in doing in fiction is, in some cases, taking characters who are doing that successfully and then breaking that world apart for them, pushing their buttons and being actually completely malevolent to these characters as the creator of their universe, to get them to freak out, to leave what they were doing, to admit the falseness of it, to change.
You mentioned your history and your dad getting out of Hungary, right? I mean, did he escape Hungary or he got out in time, or how did that...
The story changes a bit depending when you ask it, but the basics are, you know, in Hungary in 1956, there was a failed student revolution,
sure,
similar a little bit to Tiananmen Square, more recent in a lot of our memories. And he was out there on the streets, you know, during the revolution and wanted and needed to leave afterwards and escaped, ran with some friends over farmland, which was actually very dangerous because there were a lot of landmines, got out. Got to the U.S. and, you know, long twisted saga that I'm simplifying. But there are a lot of Hungarians in America who were 56ers or whose parents were 56ers here in Chicago.
A lot
especially.
Of them stayed in your basement for a time.
Yes. So we had they weren't necessarily 56ers, but, you know, I grew up up on the North Shore in the suburbs, and we had, you know, a couple beds down in our actually really gross unfinished basement. But there were, throughout the 70s and 80s, as I was growing up, there were various relatives who would get out one way or another. And our house was often the first stopping point for these people. So I grew up with sort of a, I was going to say twisted, but that's not true. I think I grew up with a very accurate sense of what America is.
For those people fighting to get here.
Yeah, right. I never took it for granted. You know, there's something I use in the first story in Music for Wartime, or actually not the first full-length story. There's a scene where this boy and his father take a recent refugee to the grocery store, and this guy is just blown away by the produce section. And that was a constant scene from my childhood, that my dad and I, or, you know, and all of us would pick someone up at O'Hare. He'd take them around the city, take them up in the Sears Tower, which, you know, if you just escaped from communist bloc country is maybe not the first thing you'd actually want to see, but it is impressive. And then take them. And then the final stop on this tour was the produce section of the Jewel. And like that is more impressive than the sky deck of the Sears Tower.
That the story you're referring to is the worst you'll ever feel. It's a
right.
beautiful story. I mean, it's about this one of the people who didn't get out, this violinist who finally, after the fall, comes to the States, and he was a mentor to the father of this young boy who ends up playing with him.
Right.
So I'm also interested in this idea. You know, there's of nurture, nature, blah, blah, blah. But your grandmother was a very successful novelist in Hungary.
Yeah.
And so here you are. So that would be nature, not nurture, because you've never read her stuff.
Well, yeah, I know. This is tricky. I have these 40 volumes that she wrote on my bookshelf, and they're all in Hungarian. And I wasn't raised bilingual, partly because Hungarian's not that useful a language if you don't think you'll ever be allowed to go back to Hungary, which was the assumption we were operating under for my whole childhood. So I can't read her work. And she, you know, she was pretty well known. Her name was Ignác Rózsa, which Hungarian names go backwards, so Rózsa would be her first name in that case. And she met me once when she was a baby. And interspersed throughout Music for Wartime, there are these stories about my family. These three short stories that I've labeled as legends.
Other Brands of Poison as well.
Right, Other Brands of Poison, which is about her, about how she claims at least to have poisoned a soldier with a bottle of ink in the middle of the Second World War. And another one about, and this one I know is true, she, before she was an author, she was an actress, a stage actress, and she would use her leftover stage makeup to paint these young women's faces to make them look old so they could go out and do resistance work without being harassed by soldiers. So, you know, she's kind of, you know, this badass person, you know, like totally impressed by her. I only met her, you know, she met me when I was a baby, and then she passed away very shortly after that. I really hope to get her novels translated either for me or for, I don't know, who else wants to read 40 random Hungarian novels translated into English.
Well, send me one. I'll read one. What the hell? Before we're done, I love talking to you, but tell me about Bach and the story there. A couple of lovers on the red background, is it?
Yeah, a couple of lovers on a red background. I think it's the most surreal story in the collection. Well, it definitely is the most surreal story in the collection. We'll just establish
Johann Sebastian Bach jumps out of a piano and lives in current day post September 11th, New York.
Yeah, and has an affair with the woman whose apartment he's in.
So it's a little fantastical.
Slightly, yeah. Right. So, people keep asking me like where the idea for that came from. And it's like, I honestly have no idea.
Well, the woman suffering law. I mean, the couple had suffered some loss of September 11th, and then she had split with her boyfriend, unable to have a baby.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, you know, I think there's a way to read the story in which literally Johann Bach is living in her apartment. And there's a much more logical way to read it, that she's projecting this and she's kind of losing it and or knows it and is just fantasizing this all. You know, it's partly, I've just always had this obsession with anachronism in a way. When I was growing up, my father would always, we'd be listening to the radio and something like the Beatles would come on and he would say, "What do you think Mozart would think of this music?" And it was, he really wanted me to answer this question. I had to sit there and answer the question then. And another
That's
time,
in one of your stories, isn't it?
Is it?
Yeah, isn't it that there's a girl in the who can't get out of the car?
Oh, it's that story. It's that story. Okay, her father won't let her out of the car till she guesses the composer. Okay. Yeah, that's very much. Although I've never had an affair with
Bach.
With Bach.
Beethoven?
Yeah, Beethoven, yes.
Okay,
just
good.
Not Bach.
Right.
Yeah, that is straight out of my childhood, actually. But I sort of all, you know, I have, because I was raised with this person asking me these strange questions, I have this sort of obsession with anachronism, specifically as it relates to music, in fact. And I think that's a lot of where that came from. How would Bach react to the music of the 20th century? And as it turns out, he gets really into the blues and starts singing them with his German accent.
He didn't like, was it Tchaikovsky?
Yeah, he hates Tchaikovsky.
Right? That's Rebecca Mackay. Everyone loves Rebecca Mackay. The collection of her short stories, it's called Music for Wartime, and it's available now. Thanks very much. It was nice to talk to you again.
Absolutely, anytime.